wise men. And here comes our caboose. Where is my other caboose? 11-3208 Burke versus 401 North Wabash Venture. Now, this isn't going to be easy. Is it Mr. Zydakis?
Is it?
Oh, I'm glad to be able to pronounce your wonderful Greek name. Wonderful. Okay.
May it please the Court, my name is John Sudeikis. I represent the appellant, Michael Burke. Your Honors, contracts, you cannot draft an enforceable agreement that allows you to take full profits if things go right, but you bear no risk for failure. You can't have an enforceable agreement that lets you bind one side if things go wrong, but if things go right, then you get to enforce it against the other side. You can't have an enforceable agreement that says, no matter what happens and no matter what I do, the best that can happen is that I have to give you your money back. Well, a promise to do something like giving you your money back is not consideration because you suffered no legal detriment. You have to give it back anyway.
Well, let's just get to what I'm trying to understand is when he's told that parking's going to be between floors 3 through 12 and then it's put on 6, how that's inconsistent. I'm having a hard time.
You can't change anything with that building, Your Honor, once you give them the property report. You need 75% of the buyers to approve
it. The sales papers say an indeterminate number of parking spaces between floors 3 and 12. That leaves lots of room for change. And how could a change be material if you went from, 3 floors to 4 floors or 4 to 5, whatever? That just seems silly.
There were also a host of other changes, Your Honor. That was just one that we used as illustrative. But the problems you have here is once you give somebody a property report, you're bound. And if you wanted to change it, first of all, you have the Condominium Act, which allows add-on parking, it's called, under Section 25. And it gives you the specific procedure to use for add-on parking, which wasn't followed. The other thing is you go to the people who bought the units, and you get 75% approval from them. If you're going to allow that to happen, then why aren't you going to enforce then Trump's provision that says he can do whatever he wants? He reserves the right to change the building and the contracts and the agreements however he wants, but then he puts pursuant to any applicable law. Well, of course, that's superfluous. The applicable law is you can't change the building. Once you give this property report to the unit owners, the only way you can do it is to go to the unit owners and get three-quarters approval from them, and that's what you didn't. Now, Trump may claim that he promised something because he's promising to sell Burke the unit. But if you take that one step further, how can Burke enforce that promise? And that's why you have cases like Markowitz and you have those HUD exemption guidelines that say if you take away this specific performance the buyer can have, the contract is not enforceable. Admittedly, they looked at it under the exemption guidelines, but the theory is the same. If I can't force Trump to sell me the unit...
Doesn't Illinois law give you that right?
It doesn't.
Give Mr. Burke that right for specific performance.
It does, but you can take it away, unfortunately, under contract, and that's what he did here, too. And we cited one of the cases, of Your Honors, that... I think it wasn't Kareem, it was Conti or something, which says if you specifically contract to take away somebody's specific performance, it's enforceable. This isn't. If the Florida courts have looked at these sort of agreements, and in fact the Florida Attorney General has brought suit against one of the developers who's used this in their agreements, the agreements can go even beyond what real property agreements are. Let's say you decided to put a deposit down on a car or put something down on layaway. Well, you go to pick up your car or you go to pick up your coat or something, and you found out they resold it for a higher price. And your only recourse then is, here, we're going to give you your money back. That's not a promise, an enforceable promise. That's sharp dealing. That's nothing but taking advantage of your contract partner, which is what happened here. Even the UCC under Section 2-719 said there must be some sort of reasonable remedy that you give the person in order for there to be an enforceable contract. If Burke cannot hold Trump to this agreement and enforce it against him, then Trump can't enforce it against Burke. There's no reciprocity or mutuality there.
Well, and here, on the mutuality issue, I really had some difficulty understanding how we could ever get around the Illinois Appellate Court's decisions in Borries and Winder, which seemed to me to reject the argument that you're making here about the purported lack of mutuality in the purchase agreement.
I have to tell you, Your Honor, at first glance, it does look like that's a very similar agreement. But then you look closely at the Schwinder case, and what happened there was they had executed what they call a PCPA, a pre-closing possession agreement. And the court was asked, did this PCPA modify the contract and open the door to remedies allowed by law and equity? And the court held that it did. And it specifically held that. And not only that, it said, even if we agree with you that we're going to enforce that provision where all you have to do is give them your money back, you're equitably estopped from that because the buyers had already moved in and made improvements. So it came very close to deciding the issue, but it decided it on other grounds. There is not a case out there that you're going to find where it says, I can breach at will, and all I have to do at best is give you your money back. Now, you'll find cases which are illusory, but those really more have to do with the illusory promises. I promise to do something if I want to. Courts would hold those to be an illusory promise. But courts have to look at the effect of the agreement as well. What is the effect of the agreement where you say, guess what? You're not going to get any damages whatsoever from me, no matter what I do. The best you're ever going to get is your money back. That's not an enforceable agreement, Your Honor. That's nothing but sharp dealing that's taken place here. And if the court doesn't have any questions, I'll reserve whatever time I have for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Novak. Hi, Mr. Novak. Look at this. It's still morning.
That being the case, I'll start off by saying good morning, Your Honors.
Yeah.
And may it please the Court. I am Steve Novak. I'm representing the defendant. Your Honors, even though plaintiff filed three complaints below, alleged some 30 counts below, his appeal reduces to four claims. Indeed, his reply brief at footnote 2, page 7, concedes that. And we filed a lengthy brief. We included arguments, sub-arguments, alternative arguments, defeating each of the four claims. And while we continue to rely on all those arguments, today I'm going to focus on one dispositive argument per claim that defeats this appeal. And I'm going to do those one by one.
Before you do, just because it's been in my head, I seem to recall that Mr. Trump did cancel some of the sales contracts back in 2007 in the hopes of obtaining better purchase prices. What happened to those buyers? Did they get anything more than their earnest money back?
Well, Your Honor, each of those cases was sort of dealt with on its own, and of course none of this is in the record.
No, I know that. I'm just a very curious.
Well, just as a matter of curiosity, I'm aware of only one of the cases' outcomes, and there was a settlement, and the buyer did get more than the earnest money. But those were different circumstances, different facts. There were insiders involved. It was the same building. And in fact, one of our cases that we rely on, Karimi, also comes out of that building, and that's the first claim, with Your Honor's permission, yeah, I'd like to address. That's the penalty claim. The claim is that under Illinois law, the purchase agreement's liquidated damage provision is somehow an invalid penalty. The answer to that screams out from the Illinois Appellate Court's decision in the Karimi case, which dealt with the identical liquidated damage provision in the same building, the Trump Tower. The purchaser there argued like here. It was a penalty, and the appellate court squarely addressed that, rejected the argument, and held that under Illinois law, the liquidated damages clause was valid and enforceable. And generally speaking, and this speaks to Your Honor's question about how can you not follow the Illinois appellate court, The rule in this court is that this court, in the absence of a dispositive Illinois Supreme Court ruling, will follow the Illinois appellate court decisions unless a compelling reason exists that, in the words of this court in the Recce case, there is a compelling reason to doubt that the courts have got the law right. Well, no such compelling reason has been shown here. And with all respect, this court can and should affirm on the basis of Karimi alone without looking at any of our other arguments, which we do reserve. The second claim I'll address is mutuality, the claim that counsel started out on. And the claim here is that because the purchaser's exclusive remedy in the event of a seller default, which, by the way, there is no allegation of seller default, the facts are the opposite. Here the seller was ready, willing, and able to close on time, and the buyer wouldn't close. But their argument is that because the contract provided that if there was a seller default, the only remedy was return of the earnest money, that makes the agreement unenforceable for lack of mutuality. Once again, as Your Honor suggested, the answer is again in the Illinois appellate reported decisions. And this time there's two of them, Schwinder and Boris. And those cases squarely address this issue, the identical mutuality issue, and found that the agreements in question, similar to ours, were not unenforceable. They were enforceable. And in fact, both cases dealt that way. Schwinder upheld a specific performance case. And Your Honor's question, didn't your client have the right to sue for specific performance? The answer is yes. How do we know? That's what Schwinder did on facts identical here. And there are no Illinois cases, not a one, that says that where earnest money is the only remedy, that renders the contract unenforceable. In fact, we're not aware of a single case anywhere in the country. And guess what? Neither is plaintiff, because plaintiff scoured those cases, and the best it could come up with were two Florida appellate cases. But neither of those cases, judges, neither of those cases invalidated a contract that contained the exclusive return of earnest money remedy. To the contrary, both of those cases enforced the contracts and gave the purchaser affirmative relief. The Ocean Dunes case affirmed specific performance, just like Schwinder. Indeed, that court said, quote, "This was an enforceable contract supported by valid consideration." The other case, Blue Lakes, affirmed award of actual money damages. And I don't have to tell you, this court has repeatedly said that it's not the role of the federal courts to create innovative state law or new claims. So we submit that the court can and should affirm on the mutuality claims on the basis of Schwinder and Boris alone, again, without any need to go to the other arguments. Now, counsel did argue that Schwinder is distinguishable because there was a modification. Yes, there was. There was. But the court had to determine first, was there a valid contract at the time of entering into the contract? And plaintiff concedes this in his reply, that that's when you measure it, in order to justify the modification and to justify specific performance. So the court didn't consider the modification for purposes of the mutuality argument. That takes us to the third claim, which is the parking claim. And I'm sort of repeating what I've heard from the bench, but one never knows if what's said from the bench is truly what you believe or what you're just raising for purpose of argument.
We say what we mean and mean what we say.
Well, if you say what you mean, yeah, then I'm not going to spend one more minute on the parking claim, because Your Honor was correct. Sixth floor is between 3 and 12, and that's the end of that issue. The last claim, is the refund claim. The argument there is that somehow the purchaser was entitled to a return of a portion of the earnest money, notwithstanding its failure to close. The earnest money deposit here was in the amount of 20% of the purchase price. The plaintiff claims that he's entitled to a refund of that portion of the earnest money deposit that exceeded 15%. And he bases that on his argument that the purchase agreement and Section 1703D of the Land Sales Act supposedly limit the maximum amount that a developer can retain to 15%. The short answer there, again dispositive, neither the contract nor the statute says any such thing. What they say is that if the earnest money deposit exceeds the greater of 15%, not just 15%, the greater of 15% and the seller's actual damages, then there is a refund. And what that means here is the plaintiff is not entitled to any refund unless defendant's actual damages were less than 20% of the purchase price. However, plaintiff has not alleged that that's the case. And it was plaintiff's burden to make that allegation to state the claim for refund. The plaintiff has the burden, it's the plaintiff's case, seeking the money back. Therefore, having not made that allegation, that claim was properly dismissed. And even though that was on a pleading ground, the court's dismissal with prejudice was also proper because the plaintiff had three chances to state a claim and couldn't do it, and the plaintiff did not ask for leave to amend the refund claim, thus waiving an argument that he ought to be entitled to amend. So, if the court has no further questions, I will not, or a desire that I address any of the other arguments, I'll end my argument a little bit early with my thanks and ask the court to affirm the decisions below.
Thank you very much, Mr. Newick.
Thank you.
So, how much time? Okay.
Courts consider the arguments raised by the parties. So if a case goes up like Karimi or Schwinder, where parties aren't alleging that the contract is invalid, the court really isn't going to reach that agreement. And if you look at Karimi, it says, talking about the unjust enrichment claims, count 5 doesn't argue that the contract was invalid, no longer in full force and effect, or otherwise unenforceable. The same thing happens in Schwinder. All of these cases are dealing with liquidated damage provisions. Both of the parties aren't raising the issue of whether the contract's enforceable. They're raising the question as to whether or not the liquidated damages clause should be upheld. And Karimi gave only 4 reasons why it felt that the liquidated damages clause should be struck down. It did not go into whether or not the agreement itself was enforceable. And like Your Honor said, why then can't Trump just sell the unit at a higher price and give anybody their money back? Well, of course, he could, because he put in this agreement, your only remedy is to get your deposit back. Now, the Interstate Land Sales Act limits you, even in the best of circumstances, to 15%, not 20% like Burke took here. And it also says damages incurred. It says the greater of 15% of your damages or the actual damages incurred. How is Burke, at the pleading stage, going to ever prove what Trump's damages incurred were? He cannot go and determine whether Trump probably even sold the building, has it under contract, or what the value of that unit is. And if Trump wanted to, all he had to do was just sit on the building for perhaps until the statute of limitations passed, then he doesn't have any damages incurred, and he could seize 20% of the purchase price. Florida cases on this abound because those are the cases where the Interstate Land Sales Act tends to be more at issue with all of the condominium building that went down there. And the courts down there, they're clear. You cannot have a heads I win, tails you lose policy. You cannot have an agreement which simply says no matter what happens, the best I'm going to have to do is give you your money back. That's not a contract and nor an enforceable contract. That's simply a way for you to take advantage of your contracting partner. This is especially so here in why Schwinder isn't appropriate. If Trump believes that his sole and exclusive remedy is the return of the earnest money, how could Schwinder ever support his position? There, Schwinder, they were able to actually compel specific performance. Here, Burke can't compel specific performance because he's taking that away from them. The only way that you could ever reach the idea of specific performance is if somehow you're going to import good faith into this contract, which is clear on its face, and somehow salvage it for Trump. But, of course, the court shouldn't do that because Trump has admitted that he thinks this agreement allows him to change the building at will and also allows him to seize the deposit with no repercussions. We ask the court, the contract is to be upheld, to at least remand the issue of whether or not Trump is allowed to seize the 20% deposit. Because under the Interstate Land Sales Act, he's limited to 15%. This 5% of deposit, which he's seized, is not only a lot of money for Mr. Burke, but it appears that given the same contract that Trump is using in the other situations, would run into the millions of dollars for the other people as well, whom Trump has probably seized their deposit. If there are no other questions.
So much.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask you to reverse the district court.
Thanks to both of you. Thanks to one and all. And the case will be taken under advisement, and this court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:30, where different faces will appear. Oh.